Somebody raised the question, is this Hilbert space separable? And I'm going to tell you some things about the Hilbert space, including that the answer to that is no. But I'm going to come back over here and start to work out some properties of this Hilbert space.
Sorry, you've already gone through things. Back to the inner product actually vanishes if you give me different graphs.
Sure. I'm going to say that. That's exactly what I'm going to say. So, I need to just tell you some properties of our measure. So, this is just, we have one edge. And we have functions on the edge. So the functions of u, I'm calling u the group elements. I have a little bit of awkward, no, I don't have awkward notation. Let me call t of u I, where this labels the representation. I'm going to say things that are true for any compact group. Okay, so these are the, actually let me call them H, because that's the holonomies, we're not tracing them. Okay. So this is the group element in the I representation. And the following thing is true, first of all, integral. So how did I notate the hard measure? Probably found it awkward. So I just called it du. But by du, we mean the Haar measure. So du of anything linear in a parallel transport operator is 0. And more generally, integral du of hi of u, hj of u. So I have two parallel transports. Is delta I j. So we require that these be the same representation. Okay. And there's a constant here, which is the Casimir operator, the Casimir of that representation. So what this implies is the following. Okay. Supposing that gamma and gamma prime are different. And all I need is one, the difference can be on an arbitrarily small place. So they can be, the two graphs can just differ anywhere. That they're distinct graphs, they're different graphs. Then psi gamma product by this inner product is 0. Moreover, with some appropriate normalization, this is actually delta gamma prime. And I apologize, I have not gone through all the normalizations. So let me just say the normalizations are in Carlo's book and in my review articles. And if you go through the normalizations, then there is a normalization in which these are orthonormal. And it means what you just said, if there are two graphs and they differ by the smallest difference in some curve, then what it would mean is that when you came to here to take the inner product, you would have something linear in one of the h's along this segment and linear in one of the h's along the other segment, so you would get 0. So this implies, that the spin network states are an orthonormal basis. So the spin network states, let me call them, what I'm calling psi gamma of A are in orthonormal basis. And this is not a delta function. This is the Kronecker delta. That is, the inner product between two spin network states is either 0 if they're distinct, or 1 if they're the same. Now, there are an uncountable number of curves in a manifold. And therefore, there are an uncountable number of graphs. And therefore, this is not a countable basis. That is, these are basis elements, but they're not countable. There's a continuous set of basis elements. Now, proving that there's no countable basis is what you would have to do to prove it's non-separable, but indeed, you can prove that. I'm not going to do it now. So this is not a countable basis, nor is there any other, so it's non-separable. And that may be scary, but it's a, remember that I just defined the kinematical Hilbert space, not the space of diffeomorphism invariant states, which I'll be defining sometime soon.
Sorry.
Yes.
Can you say kinematical Hilbert space having imposed any of the constraints?
I've imposed gauge and ordinary SU2 gauge invariants. Not the diffeomorphism, no spatial diffeomorphisms, just that under ordinary SU2 gauge transformations, I just have gauge invariant state. It would not hurt me very much to relax that, because in fact, all I would have to do is just have open edges. And if I just added that and just had parallel transports that were open, I could go to a space of not gauge invariant states. But the way that I set it up, I have only gauge invariant states. So that's actually all I need.
So if you can you find a different space without imposing any fields, then
yes.
Once you impose that, you get exactly parallel transports.
Exactly, yes. Yes. Okay. So I want to go through my properties. And the next property on the list, so I've shown that this is a Hilbert space. I've shown you a basis. I've shown you that it's not a countable basis. And now I'm going to take advantage of that property that's not a countable basis to show you how to unitarily implement the diffeomorphisms of the spatial manifold. So let phi be an element of the diffeomorphism group of the spatial manifold. Then, given a graph, any graph, phi takes it to another graph, gamma prime, which is phi acting on the graph. Given a graph, which is a set of points in a manifold, and a diffeomorphism, it moves it to another graph in a manifold. And therefore, I can define an operator U of phi that takes one of these states and as a function of A, it's equal to psi of phi inverse on gamma evaluated at A. So I just move the state by the inverse of the diffeomorphism. And this, by the way, is also equal to psi of gamma on the diffeomorphism acting on the A's. Now, this is a basis element, and this is a basis element. This has norm 1, and this has norm 1. So this is a operator u hat, which takes basis elements of norm 1 to basis elements of norm 1. So therefore, in this, with this definition, this is a unitary operator. So it takes norm 1 basis elements to norm 1 basis elements. And I can do that for any diffeomorphism. And you can check the group property, you know, u of phi, u hat of phi, u hat of phi prime. Sorry, I'm writing, I'm so impatient, I'm writing too fast. Is u hat on phi prime, phi acting on phi prime, and so on. So I get a unitary realization of the diffeomorphisms. Okay? Now notice that that property, to get that property, I'm making use of the non-separability of the Hilbert space. I'm making use of the fact that if I take any graph and move it by any non-zero diffeomorphism, I get a, starting with the basis state, I get a basis state that's orthogonal to it. And since there's an infinite continuum of diffeomorphisms, and also since I can make a diffeomorphism act just in an arbitrarily small region, I could only hope to do that with a non-countable basis, with an infinite continuum of basis states. So I make strong use of that here. Okay, so I have this, and the others will be even easier.
So the idea of this is that diffeomorphism shouldn't change transition amplitude expectation value.
Well, sure, and the inner product, the inner product is diffeomorphism invariant that is psi phi, you can explicitly check, you know, is u of the diffeomorphism on psi, u on the diffeomorphism, u of the diffeomorphism on phi. So the inner product is diffeomorphism invariant. And it's just totally simple and explicit. There's no, and you know, people often worry about anomalies, central charges, central terms, and things like that. And in this case, there is no anomaly, there's no central extension. This is just the representation. Yes?
This is still a spatial diffeomorphism.
Yes. Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes. And we have to worry about consistency. We will have to worry about consistency of this with the implementation of the Hamiltonian constraint. Okay. Now, what about implementing this operator? The operator that creates a graph that is the Wilson loop of a, well, here I wrote just the loop, but actually, why not just have, since I have a Wilson loop associated with the graph, why not just write that? So here's the definition. I have an operator, t hat, associated to every graph, acting on a state, evaluated as a function of A, and remember that all the functions of A that have support in this measure are really functions of Wilson loops, but so is this functions of Wilson loops. So this is just the classical object, T gamma of A, multiplying times the state, which is a function of some other T's. And that defines an operator. It's a kind of creation operator. Okay. Now, you can check that these commute with each other, that is t hat gamma T hat gamma prime as operators commute. Doesn't matter what order you multiply them. Okay. So, which is good because they all have vanishing Poisson brackets with each other. Okay. Now, to do the next one, the T1, I have to remind you about the Poisson bracket. But let me do it this way. If I show you, there's an easier and a harder way to do this. If I show you how an operator acts on a basis, I showed you everything, right? So the things that I call the psi gamma of A states, the basis elements associated with the spin network, okay, are this operator I just defined acting on psi zero, where psi zero of A, somewhere I wrote it, is one. Okay? Therefore, I can define an operator for my T1. This is up there. It's the operator that has a conjugate electric field at a point, acting on a basis state, psi gamma of A. And I'm just going to define this to be the Poisson bracket of TA of gamma of S. I mean, you have this, the value of this Poisson bracket in your notebooks from some time ago, with the Wilson loop of gamma and A acting on psi zero. That is, and let me spell out what it is. So the Poisson bracket, to make it simple, I think the thing we have in the notebooks is in the case where there's just a single loop. So let me remind you, if I have a single loop, say, gamma, and another loop that might intersect it, alpha, and there's an intersection point S, the Poisson bracket of T gamma, just the Wilson loop, with the TA of alpha of S, was the integral dt, where t is, let's see, which is gamma is, where t is on the Wilson loop, a delta 3 of gamma of t with alpha of s, and gamma dot a at t. So that pulled down the tangent vector. There's an index a here, and that gets applied to the tangent vector of the Wilson loop. And then this was multiplied by the Wilson loop of the loop alpha combined with the loop gamma, minus the Wilson loop of the loop alpha combined with gamma inverse. So that's what the Poisson bracket looked like if you look back in your notes. And so, for example, that means that the operator TA alpha of that, sorry for the change of the alpha to gamma, with psi, the spin network state associated with just a single loop gamma of A, is exactly equal to that, which is a state because it's a function of Wilson loops. So it is a state. That is, let me write it out, it's this singular factor, integral dt, delta 3, gamma of t, alpha of s, gamma dot a of t, times the basis state psi of alpha with gamma, minus the basis state psi with alpha with gamma inverse. So that's the action of the operator in this particular case. Okay, so I've defined an operator, and I've defined it so it has the action on holonomies or parallel transports with this guy as functions of. It has the action that the classical Poisson bracket has of this guy on those states. And all that's really happening, the extra loop here is just coming along for the ride to make things gauge invariant. All that's really happening is that there's an electric field sitting at that point. And the electric field sitting at that point is grasping onto the loop that goes through that point. But that electric field is traced against the parallel transport to make a gauge invariant around some other loop alpha. And the result is that you get that loop broken and cemented with the loop that gets grasped. And you get this combination in which you get the difference between putting them together with one orientation and putting them together with the opposite orientation. There are some other things to check about this formula. For example, the Wilson loops, I told you, don't depend on the parameterization on the curve. So everything has to be independent of the parameterization on the curve. And indeed, this factor is an integral dt times a gamma dot, which is d gamma dt. So this factor is invariant under parameterization of the curve. And it is gauge invariant as it has to be. Okay, so we're trying to reproduce the algebra. The Wilson loops commute. We represent the T1s with the electric field with the T's. We represent that by definition, because I defined the action of the operator in terms of the Poisson bracket. So we get that for free, and then you have to check this, and I'll leave this for you to check, that you get the T1s with the T1s. And in the end, we indeed faithfully represent that algebra. And again, let me emphasize, without anomaly, the real quantum mechanical algebra on this infinite dimensional, in fact, continuous infinite dimensional Hilbert space is represented faithfully. The Poisson algebra is represented faithfully by the commutator algebra. Yeah.
What's the extra
length? There is none at the moment.
You need something which gives zero, otherwise you're lucky as well.
I think that's the issue.
It just looks like you don't have an
imagination of brain. The issue is defining it precisely in such a way that it really takes normalizable states to normalizable states. Let me think about it. A long time ago, I thought about that, like 15 years ago, and it may be that that's now understood, but I haven't thought about that. Okay, so this is a Hilbert space, and the I have to do one more thing, because there are other operators we want to define on the space. And there are several ways to do this, to do the following. And it will be easier if I have some notation. So let me go back and imagine that I just, let me just separate out. Well, let me tell you what my problem is, and then I'll do it. What we've defined is operators that take configuration variables and turn them into operators. So the Wilson loops are configuration variables. The states, in a certain sense, I defined here are functions of the Wilson loops. And we've defined operators associated with those configuration variables. The T1s are operators linear in the conjugate momentum. And roughly speaking, whatever quantization procedure one takes, one can always get away with turning configuration variables into operators and turning operators which are linear in momentum into operators. And the reason why that's true is that if you think about the configuration space, momenta are vector fields on the configuration space. They give you rates of change on the configuration space. And therefore, if you go back to the geometrical picture in which momenta are like vector fields, or represented by vector fields on the configuration space, you can always, for free, figure out how to represent vector fields as derivative operators acting on functions on a configuration space. So modulo technical issues of norms and so forth, you should not be surprised if you can get this far. What makes quantum field theory challenging in every context is that there are operators which are of higher order in momentum. What makes quantum field theory challenging is that you want to represent, for example, in Hamiltonians, momentum squared, electric field squareds, and field Hamiltonians, and so forth. And that is where all the trouble starts. In addition, we want to define operators like the Hamiltonian constraint. So remember that the Hamiltonian constraint starts off, it has EE, I'll just do it schematically, EEF, and then it has the cosmological constant times EEE, and all three E's are at the same point. So if we want to understand dynamics, we have to understand operators which are quadratic and cubic in momenta. And we have to understand them acting at the same point. And all the issues of quantum field theory, divergences, anomalies, etc., come from momenta operating at the same point. So how do we deal with them? To deal with them in any quantum field theory, what we do is we don't deal with them directly. We invent a regularization procedure. Another way to say it, let me just say it schematically. Another way to say it is that electric fields are always densities. Conjugate momenta in field theories are always densities. And therefore, E's on psi of A are always naively, I haven't yet written this formula, but naively they look like IH bar, some variational derivative by A in a point of some functions of A. And one way or another, this is a density, and it's going to turn into a distribution. One way or another, in that action, you're going to get things that look like delta D of x and some other points. You're going to get distributional quantities. Okay. And distributions, as I emphasized early in the lectures, are densities. Now, that's at some point x. Now, if I try to invent E of x times, this is an operator, E of x times E of x, formally, if I close my eyes, it looks like I can get away with it because that's just delta squared, delta A of x, delta A of x on some functional. But just by density weights, that's going to want to look like a delta function of d at a point x, some other things, squared. And distributions do not square, because distributions are things that are only defined by multiplying them against, I'm sorry, by integrating them against smooth functions. Distributions don't square. So if distributions don't square, operators at the same point don't square. The operators at the same point don't exist. There's no such thing as E of x times E of x. Now, one way or another, what you have to do is the following. You have to define, and I'm squeezing myself into a corner here to say, but you have to define some E of x squared operator, that is some operator to represent what you mean, by a limit of something. For example, a limit of you do E at y and E of x, you define that. You define some integrals over things that smooth out the distributions into functions, and then you take at the end the limit y goes to x. And so what that means is the limit y goes to x, some integrals over things, delta dy, so let's call these things, say, z's, y of z, delta d, x of z, some other functions, and this is a different z than that, so dz, dz prime, some functions of stuff. Okay. Then you evaluate out, so you just have smooth things, and then in the end you can take the limit of y goes to x, and that's what you're going to mean by E at x squared. It's generic. I'm just giving you a schema. Okay? Now, there are many, many different ways to do this in both ordinary background dependent string theory, also quantum field theory, and background independent quantum field theory. Okay. There are different prescriptions. These are called regularization prescriptions. Normal ordering is just one. It's the most familiar of these. Typically, such things, A, depend on the scheme. That is, if you and some friends have six different ways to approach this, and let's say you check it, that is, that just on classical variables, the limit of these things on classical variables goes back to E squared on classical variables. So that's a property you might like it to have. Okay, but you have six different ways of doing it through different versions of this. Typically, you're going to get six different answers. Okay. Typically, the answer is dependent on the path by which y goes to x. And typically, the answer breaks every property you might like the theory to have. For example, if the original product of classical expressions was gauge invariant or diffeomorphism invariant, typically the result is neither. also typically the result is divergent. Okay? So all the details of quantum field theory have to do with how you do this. Okay, and that's any quantum field theory whatsoever. So that's a sort of generic lesson. What's the attitude here? And the attitude here is there are basically three tricks that get used over and over again in flat loop quantum gravity kinds of subjects. Okay. So, trick one is the following. Let me again keep talking about, say, E squared. So, trick one is supposing that, let me give an example. Supposing we wanted to do E of X A, E of X B. Classically, that's the inverse tree metric times the determinant of the tree metric. We worked that out before. So this is an object which classically exists, and we might like an operator for it. Okay. Well, so typically, what one does is one, first of all, separates the two points. So one has E at X and E at Y. But then one has lost gauge invariance because I can no longer trace E at X because they rotate under local SU2 transformations separately at separate points. So I have to pick some curve eta XY between those two points. And then I have to consider trace of EA of X parallel transport along the curve A to XY, EB at Y parallel transport back along the curve Y to X. And that's a gauge invariant object, and I can turn that into an operator. And that operator, this is the point that you made, depends on the choice of path. One can then try to extract limits as you bring the points together, but there's going to be delicacies about the path dependence. In any case, this is the kind of thing that we do. And I'll be doing more of it. But what is this operator? How do I define this operator on these states? How do I turn this into an operator? And the basic algorithm is that we have an expression for E. Let me put it this way. I have an expression for E hat I, AI, at some point X, acting on a Wilson loop, or generically on a parallel transport operator of some curve gamma in some representation J. And what that is an object that is the integral. This is, and I'm going to write this, and then I'm going to be giving this in a name because I do it over and over again. ds gamma dot a at the point s delta 3 x of gamma of s. This is the singular factor which is always there. Okay. And this, if you like, I forgot to say what I'm doing, but let's say I'm writing this as minus I h bar d by dA a I and x of mu. So for a single d, I can work it out either by the variational derivative, which I did a long time ago, or through the Poisson bracket as I have up there. And it's always this factor times the parallel transport along the first part of the curve, a Pauli matrix or a representation generator in the representation J of the generator I. So I have the curve here, here's the curve gamma. There's, if I only get a non-zero value from this, if x is somewhere on the curve, in which case there's a first part of the curve, gamma 1, and the second part of the curve that's broken there. And what I end up doing is inserting, and there's no I here, sorry. I end up inserting the generator associated with the I element there. Yeah, there is an I here, sorry. Of the representation J between the product of the two parallel transports. So rather than, so I parallel transport the first part, I insert the generator, and then I parallel transport the rest of the way. This factor occurs over and over again, and it's sometimes written gamma of A, and it's a function of X, and that's all. No, it's a function of X and curve. So that's how 1E acts. And that's called the grasp, in quotes. Okay? The E grabs the curve on which the parallel transport is. Okay. Well, if you can do that, you can do the following. If I have a product of E's, EA1 at a point X1 to EAN at a point XN, all points distinct, then I can define these operators on a parallel transport in the following way: a product over I of delta of xi ai gamma. So that is, now I have a number of points. And I first have the singular factors, which are zero unless the point is on the curve. So this is going to be zero unless all the points are on the curve. And then I break up the curve into curve one going to first guide, curve two going to the second guide, curve three going to the third guide, and so forth. And so then I have products of mu gamma 1, tau in the jth representation. I1 to IN, sorry, in the jth representation, I1 to, you know, u gamma n minus 1, tau in the jth representation, I n minus 1, u gamma and n. So in other words, I have the product of the action of all those operators. And as long as they're at distinct points, it makes sense. And I can do that. Okay. Now, therefore, if I have anything of the form of the trace of some number of e's at distinct points, separated by the u's, what I'm saying is, I now make a big curve, and I put my e's inside the curve, always at distinct points. And I go from the first e, e1, to the second e, to the third e, always by a parallel transport along that curve that they're all on. But I have an object like this. This guy is called by a generalization, if there are any of them, it's called the Tn. It depends on indices A1, and we call it this way A1, A2, etc. It depends on the curve, and it depends on the points S1, S2, S3, where these are, S1, S2, S3. Okay. And now I know how to turn this into an operator. I just act with all the e's, and then I multiply with all the u's. And when I do that, I get something which is just a function of the parallel transport. Okay. It's a mess to write out, but associated with this, there's an operator, t hat n, of a1 to an on this curve, gamma, S1 to Sn, and acting on some parallel transport guy, I'm using gamma twice, unfortunately. Let me call this gamma still, let me call this alpha. Apologies, so this is a curve alpha. This is just the u of alpha 1, u of alpha n, all multiplied into that up there. And that's just some traces of u's. In the end, it's gauge invariant, because at every, I either get zero, or the curve I acted on went through all those points. In which case, I broke each of the two curves into segments, and I'm multiplying them together and defining some path through them. And I have some product of t's along the path segments. Okay, so it's a bit complicated to write it out, and I if you want me to next time, I can write it out with a useful notation. But you get the idea that I can define all of these operators of this kind. Okay, now, these are very singular operators because I have these deltas everywhere here, which are singular expressions. So if I try to turn this into an algebra, I'm going to be in trouble because I have the problem of possibly multiplying two operators together at the same point to try and take the commutator of two operators at the same point. So then what I have to do is integrate these guys against one form fields. So let me just define the first thing. I have to define a guy T of phi, okay, and a loop alpha, which is the integral on the manifold of some one form, phi A, times T hat A of the curve alpha. And this depends on also the point S. And the point, and what I'm doing, actually, yeah, so I have to define, wait. The way I set it up, sorry, this is a one form on the curve, and I'm integrating this on the curve. Okay. So now I integrate the guy around the curve, and I can eliminate some of the singular behavior. So what I have to do, and I'm hesitating because I'm realizing I've got myself into a corner, so it's a good time to be coming to a close. You have to actually now invent some sets of curves which allow you to integrate out completely these delta functions, and I'll do that next time. And the point is that you can make an algebra of these kinds of objects with an arbitrary number of these at different points. And by suitably smearing out and integrating over smooth functions, you can make a well-defined algebra acting on all of these states that we've defined. So these are well-defined operators in this kinematic or Hilbert space. Now, and I apologize, I mean, all this stuff is technical and tricky, but it just is technical and tricky. The work is for operators of physical interest, like the Hamiltonian constraint, areas of surfaces, bounds of regions, terms in the Hamiltonian constraint which couple to matter fields, so the kinds of things that come, the kinds of dependencies on the metric and the connection that come into couplings to matter fields. You have to define regularizations such that you get operators which are completely well-defined on the kinematical Hilbert space, but carry a lot of redundant regularization-dependent information with them. And this is not really different than one does with ordinary quantum field theory. For example, one smears fields against smooth test functions and so forth. It's just that it's a little bit intricate what spaces of smooth test functions you have to smear things against to get a well-defined algebra of operators. Once you have all of that, the operators of interest are defined by taking limits in which the points are brought together. So say in this case, these two points are brought together. Okay. And you have to show that you can extract physically meaningful operators on states that are diffeomorphism invariant. So another thing that I haven't yet discussed is that sitting amongst the states that we defined are a subspace of states which are diffeomorphism invariant, which I will talk about next time. And we want to extract good, physically unambiguous, well-defined operators acting not just on these, on all states, but just on states which are diffeomorphism invariant, which are the states that are physically meaningful. And so there's a lot of delicate study and taking of limits, the end of which is that there are, you know, half a dozen or to a dozen meaningful operators defined, including the ones that I mentioned. Okay, questions? And this is the nitty-gritty of the subject. And so we're, it's not fun, but we have to study it. And what we're going to do next time is study it on a few operators. I'll discuss this operator here, which is important because if you remember, this comes in, this is exactly the object that comes in to the Poisson bracket of two Hamiltonian constraints. So if we're going to make sense of the operator with the Hamiltonian constraint in it, we have to make sense of this operator. And then we'll talk about the area and the volume and how we're coming. And I think both because I want to stop a little early because I'm responsible for the speaker today. And also just because from here on in it's heavy and I think we should start fresh. And then there's several hours of just heavy cranking through these examples. Okay, questions?